Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us for this morning's show. In this first part of the program, we'll be talking with the filmmaker Warrington Hudlin. He is generally acknowledged to be an authority on African-American cinema. He is the president, one of the founders of the Black Filmmaker Foundation, and has played a very important role in the emergence of the contemporary Black independent film movement. He has been a curator and programmer for Black film festivals around the world, in this country, in Europe, in Africa, and the Caribbean. He's also been producer and director of popular films, just mentioned a couple, House Party and Boomerang. House Party established a kind of a new genre in American cinema, the hip-hop film, and his movie Boomerang, that starred Eddie Murphy, did very well. In fact, it's one of the highest-grossing romantic comedies of all time. He's here visiting in Champaign-Urbana. He's going to give a talk in the Millercom series, talking about some of his experiences as a filmmaker. That will be this afternoon at 4 o'clock at the Levis Center on the campus on West Illinois Street. And of course, these programs are always free and open to the public. Anybody who is interested should feel welcome to stop by and hear what he has to say. Also on the program here this morning, questions are welcome, as always, 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, and toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, thanks very much for being here.
A pleasure, pleasure.
Appreciate it. The question, and I mentioned to you just before we started that I thought the place to start, and obviously this is something we could talk about a lot for a long time, is this question. Today, what is a black film? When we say something is a black film, what exactly does that mean?
Yeah, it's a very important question, because it's something that sometimes has a shifting definition. But in an attempt to lock that definition down, we use a definition that the motivation is really trying to protect a movement. And so the same way that you can protect American industry by saying made in America brand in your label, and therefore buy American, well, we protect the notion of black film by saying a black film is a movie that either the African-American is the director, mm-hmm. or the writer and producer in combination. And by using that definition, what we're doing, we're saying it's very important that the role of the author, the person who's really saying what's being expressed, is in the hands and control of African American. Otherwise, a movie in which the cast is largely African American could be considered a black film. And I must say, it's sometimes tempting to go that way, mm-hmm. because under that definition, you know what's a black film?
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to shock you.
Mm-hmm.
The Matrix.
I was going to ask you about that, because I came across a really interesting piece discussing this very issue. It was published in August in the Denver Post, and you're quoted several times here. And in fact, that very issue comes up, and the author writes, the piece writes, "If the blackness of a film was determined by a kind of comfort with the themes of race, then the Wachowski brothers, the guys who made The Matrix, are proving it in their own way with The Matrix Reloaded." And in the words of the writer for the Post here, it says that Matrix Reloaded shows that white guys can shoot a black movie. And you're quoted as saying, "The movie that I find really turns that on its head is The Matrix. That is as black as you're going to get."
For
the
sure.
Matrix,
yes.
is a black movie. Or, well, you might, you
well,
might
I mean,
say
I, if you a person subscribes to that definition, then yes. And by the way, what faces me and my colleagues every day is that we're going to present ideas. It's, oh, no, we can't give you this kind of budget because it's a black movie and black movies don't make money. Well, I see The Matrix made a lot of money.
Mm-hmm. Well, how about a movie like, well, for example, a recent movie by John Singleton, Too Fast, Too Furious. It set a record for opening weekend for a film by a black director. Is that a black movie?
Yes, because, again, he's a director, and he had that really big control. But what's important about that movie, Fast and Furious, is the really breakthrough with multicultural casting. Remember the poster? You have an African-American, a Latina, mm-hmm. an Asian woman, I mean, a young white guy. You're really saying this is American youth. And what's interesting, there's been some new statistical reports that while African-Americans may be what, 12-13% of American population, people of color are 40% of American youth. And then when you add the fact that we drive youth tastes, then American youth, you know, it's really multicultural, which is why hip-hop has such currency because it's a expression of youth culture that by definition is multicultural.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess it's also interesting to think about that. One of the most successful films about rap ever made probably was the movie that starred the white rapper.
Eminem.
Mm-hmm. So I guess it says something about how lines are getting very blurry.
Yes, and I think in some ways that's a good thing. You know, I think that racial polarization has always been part of the problem getting along in this country. Now, just think about 8 Mile, Eminem's movie, is that the subtext of that movie is that class trumps race. And throughout the film, his whole thing about him not being accepted as a white rapper, but the fact that he was from 8 Mile, the other side of the tracks, that became his street credibility. And so that's an interesting presentation, the notion that class trumps race.
Yeah. What about the idea that for something to be a black film, that it needs to be about the experiences of black people? So then by that, I guess you would say, well, maybe Barbershop is a black film, but I'm trying to think of some other film that maybe has a lot of black actors in it, but that doesn't... It's not really about the black experience.
Yeah, my brother, who's obviously African-American, did a film in which there was no significant African-American. He did a film called Serving Sarah. Mm-hmm. Matthew Perry, Elizabeth Hurley. Now, that's pretty white. Mm-hmm. But my brother, as a director, really made sure that his sensibility was present. So I'm really interested in using that definition. The question is, definition for what purpose? Mm-hmm. And so the purpose of my definition is to try to empower the author. And so by that definition, African-American director makes it a black film independent of the subject matter. In the same way that I film without an African-American director, let's call it Color Purple, let's call it Amistad, would not qualify.
Yeah. One of the things that, and I think particularly back to perhaps it was when John Singleton made Boys in the Hood, and then there were a number of movies kind of that genre. I think a lot of people were looking at the representations of African Americans, and they were unhappy. They were saying, you know, here we have a lot of movies where there's a lot of violence, and there's a lot of unhappiness, and there's a lot of dysfunctional families. And they said, you know, why can't we show different representations of African Americans, show people who are middle class African Americans or working class people who have healthy, strong families, and you know, that sort of thing. They wanted a different kind of movie. Then it seemed the dilemma, though, was that sometimes when one of those movies would come along, and maybe there are more movies like that now, but one of those movies would come along, the mass black audience didn't seem interested. So I think people sort of scratched their head and said, well, what's going on here? There, people say they want better movies, and yet when a movie is made, they don't go to see it.
Well, I think the key is it has to be a better movie. Because a lot of movies that stay within that kind of hood formula, they didn't make money either. What made money was a good movie. Boys in the Hood was a good movie. And so we confuse the fact that was a good movie in a specific subject matter and genre and characters as that's the value, the commercial appeal of that circumstance. No, it's the commercial appeal of that filmmaker's well-executed vision. Now, these other types of stories, which I think we should have a multiplicity of stories, when well executed, it makes money. For example, a movie that I think is amazing that came out last year was Drumline. Mm. Now, Drumline is set in a college campus. So clearly, this is not a hood, shoot 'em up kind of movie, and it made a lot of money. I think expanded the boundaries of the genre. So the thing is, a good movie makes money, a bad movie doesn't. So whether or not it's an urban hood movie, so-called, if it's poorly executed, it would not do well.
We're talking here this morning with the filmmaker Warrington Hudlin. He's here visiting the campus to talk about some of his experiences and to talk about African-American cinema, something that he knows a lot about. He is the president, one of the founders of the Black Filmmaker Foundation. He's also been a producer and director of feature films. Questions, welcome. We have somebody here standing by and would welcome others. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Here's a caller, somebody on cell phone, line number one. Hello.
Hi. I think you need to modify that to say that a good film that's marketed correctly does well. And one of the problems we're having now in theaters is that all movies are coming and going so rapidly. Basically, anything that comes out will take over the number one spot, regardless of the quality. And there's a problem with having theaters hold a film long enough to build an audience. One black film that was a revelation to me, and I may not have the name right, but I think it was called Love, Jones.
Yes.
Which took place in Chicago.
Yes.
And it was about what I would say, I don't know if it's middle or upper middle, but let's say it was actually metropolitan sort of intellectual. It was a high level. I don't know. You know what?
No, absolutely.
Describe it better than I can. And I didn't know that existed.
Yes.
And I was absolutely, I've seen, you know, Soul Food and all of those, and those are very much, they may be really black films, but they are black films that fit into the stereotypes that we already had of blacks. And this was a group of a black community that I didn't even know existed, and I was just really impressed by that.
I think your point is well taken, because, and actually I know the behind the scenes on that particular production. Love Jones was made at a time when the president of marketing for that studio, New Line Cinema, was fired right before the film came out. And a new marketing team came out, and it was really literally an orphaned project. And you're right, if the marketing is not in place, the filmmaker can do their job, but the people who are in charge of getting it in front of us to make it come to our attention can drop the ball. So Love Jones is a good example of a film that is this absolutely fabulous. I agree with you. It was a revelation, but the marketing let it go.
Let me ask you one question, if I could. I'd just like to hear your comments. There's been controversy about using Anthony Hopkins in Human Stain, and what do you think about that? Do you think that if you're playing a role of a black person passing as white, that you should have a... Does it matter? Or does it matter to you as to the authenticity? Can a white person ever play even a black person trying to be white?
I think the answer is yes. My concern is who gets the paycheck. You know, so I'm always trying to get my actor friends' paychecks. And I know I have actor friends who could play that part. I mean, in fact, Roger Smith, if you're watching K Street on HBO, he plays the character Dupree. I mean, his skin color is such that he's racially ambiguous. So, but again, I mean, these decisions are really made on a star's box office appeal and the ability for them to move the video sales. The interesting thing about people, that whole part of our history of African Americans who passed for white, those people you would not know. And so in terms of authenticity, if they were, if their chromosomes roll that way, you would look at them and not know. I experienced that too long ago in New Orleans. And this woman had blonde hair and blue eyes, but let me know. And she was African American. And I talked to her, yeah, she was. But on site, I would never, ever know.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Thanks for the call. Just to pick up on one of the points the caller made, as I think that it's certainly true, and I'm sure that it frustrates filmmakers, there are a lot of films made now. And there's a lot of pressure, and I think particularly the pressure comes from the exhibitors, from the theaters, to move films if they don't do huge business right away. And as the caller said, I think that there would have been a time when maybe a film would have had a chance to build some word of mouth. People would see it, say, hey, this is a pretty good film, would tell their friends, and build audience over time. Now, if you don't have a blockbuster opening weekend, you're through. Is there anything that can be done about that, or is it just a reality of the business thing?
Well, keep in mind, there are two different theater tracks in America. The mainstream screens, yes, those things, you have to produce big numbers quick or you lose your space. But there's another circuit, the so-called art house circuit. I'm very encouraged by Mark Cuban's company, somebody recently buying the Landmark Theater chain. And I've had a conversation with them, and they're very interested in supporting the art movies. And a movie, for example, that has had tremendous staying power, it was one of my favorites of last year, Bowling for Columbine. Mm. I mean, here's a movie that just, in fact, right now I think it has the distinction of being the highest grossing documentary of all time.
That's right. Yeah.
So when you really come strong, people support it. But there should, and there is, there are theater chains that specialize in those so-called art movies. And that's where they really live.
Let's talk with someone else here. Line 2 in Champaign. Hello.
Good morning and welcome.
Thank you.
I'd like to piggyback off of what you're saying. I was a staff writer for Mary Tyler Moore Productions, Hill Street Blues, and also I was a staff writer for Different Strokes. Now, that's, you know, I was television, but we were instructed at times, you know, especially for Hill Street Blues, if the situation warranted, if it was a black situation or a drug situation. I was a staff writer, so I was a contributing writer and had to do what the executive writers wanted you to do. So in many scenarios, we had to produce what we knew or write what we knew about a situation, whether it was relative to a drug situation or relative to a pimp situation, and you had to write like that. You just had to have experience, and that was our guideline. And another thing I wanted to say about, you're talking about movies that really didn't do well, that should have done well because of the marketing. I think On the Bus, Spike Lee's movie, should have been seen by everybody because doing the Million Man March and everything, I think it had something to say to everybody. But it was, you know, dubbed as a black movie and dubbed, but it had so much information for this country, period. What are your sentiments on that? And my other question, the last question is, where are black filmmakers going when the budget now for a low-budget film is $20
million? That's low-budget, too.
That's low-budget. And some of the actors are getting $20 million themselves. So my twofold question is, what did you think about Spike Lee's movie being an all-time movie, should have been seen by everybody? And secondly, where are we going with low budget now, since low budget now, $20 million is what the actor gets?
Well, on the Kill on the Bus, which, by the way, I agree with you, was a very, very good movie that many people should have seen. But interesting, I'm going to surprise you. I blame that on Spike Lee.
Oh, really?
Because Minister Louis Farrakhan offered him help to market the movie.
Okay.
And here's a man who got 1 million people on the Washington Mall. He can get 1 million people in the theater. But Spike Lee said no, distanced himself from that project.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was an incredible mistake, because literally, if 1 million people, if the people who simply were at the march bought a ticket, you know, with, you know, $5 to $10 a piece, that's a lot of money.
That is a lot of money. And Spike Lee and I started out together. I mean, when he was taking points to do She's Gotta Have It, I was living in Los Angeles, and Helen Martin, who plays on 227, befriended me. I was working at the May Company, and I told her, she knew that I was a writer, and she told me there's this guy in town taking points, and he wanted to do a film. He was doing a film called She Gotta Have It. But because my work schedule at the May Company, I was just out of the University of Illinois.
Wow.
And I had to work, and I could not contribute on that film, but he was taking points at the time.
Yeah, so, well, we both go back, because if you look at the credits on She's Gotta Have It, She's Gotta Have It was produced in association with the Black Filmmaker Foundation. I remember he came in my office and said, hey, I got this idea for a movie, and I'm going to try to get some grants, but I can't, as an individual receiver grant, I need a not-for-profit agency to be my fiscal agent.
Exactly.
And so we became his fiscal agent. And the thing I really regret, I have one of this, you know, in life, there's regrets. At one point, the film was almost finished. He said, man, I'm short a couple thousand dollars. Can you hook me up? I said, Spike, really, man, I'll help you much as I can, but, you know, I can't personally put money in your project. Now, if I had, I would be all right right now.
But
you know, hindsight is 2020. That's right.
Okay, it was a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you.
Thank you for the call. We'll go on here. We have another caller. This person is in Urbana, line 1. Hello.
Good morning. Very interesting discussion. My question was about the fact that I've seen two movies in the last year. Unfortunately, I don't see as many as I would like because I have a small child. But I saw
Blockbuster Nights.
Yeah, I know. We got a Sony PlayStation, so you can watch DVDs on it.
Yes.
And we saw 25th Hour recently, which I believe is a Spike Lee movie.
Yes.
Wonderful movie, very good direction, very tight. But it's about ethnic Europeans. And then I believe Barbershop, when we saw that, was directed by an ethnic European, but it's about African Americans. So I'm very intrigued by this, and I think it's great that other people are portraying other people's cultures. And I heard your definition of black film, which seemed very appropriate. So I'd just like to hear your comments on that, and especially on Spike Lee doing a movie about mainstream American culture. And thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Actually, this point of clarification, Barbershop was written, produced, and directed by African Americans. 25th Hour, I think that's really opens a very important new avenue for African American filmmakers. You're right, the cast was Rosario Dawson is a Latina. She has a prominent role, but otherwise, it's primarily white Americans in principal roles. Now, an interesting thing about this kind of cross-cultural filmmaking is that when you are in a subordinate group in the country, you have to have and Du Bois talks about this, have a dual consciousness. You have to really know how they think and act, as well as how you think and act, in order to navigate successfully the political landscapes. So in many ways, African Americans are really more empowered to tell the stories of the white Americans because they have to really pay attention, not to get stepped on, squeezed out, etc. While a white American director has to be really, really, really super aware, alert, and sensitive in order to make that kind of that transition. However, it does work. A good example of that for me is Hurricane. I thought that Norman Jewison did a brilliant job. In fact, I often look at the performance of Denzel Washington in Hurricane versus Malcolm X. And this character is very similar. And I don't know if you know this, the backstory, but Malcolm X was originally supposed to be directed by Norman Jewison, but Spike Lee went to Warner Brothers and said, "This is a black man has to direct, you know, the movie." And, you know, I listened to the rationale, and I, of course, at the time, support the rationale. But in terms, to be fair, I thought that performance of Denzel Washington in Hurricane was more Malcolm X than it was in Malcolm X. I don't know if you guys agree with that, but it was an incredibly powerful performance. And I go one step further. I think the Academy gave him the Academy Award. Of course, he won it for Training Day, but I think it was a guilt because he didn't get it for Hurricane. And that's a pattern in the Academy. Sidney Poitier got it for Lilies of the Field, but he should have got it because they didn't give him for Heat of the Night. Al Pacino got it for Sin the Woman, but he didn't get it for The Godfather. Oftentimes, the Academy would not. They will kind of balance off the sheet. They miss the years. Well, we'll get you later. Mm. Well, that's an example of that. And I think that any fair-minded person knows that Hurricane was just a otherworldly performance by Denzel Washington. And so he was finally acknowledged and rewarded.
When the Academy Awards were given out in 2002 and the top acting awards went to Denzel Washington and Halle Berry, I think people said, well, first of all, they said, well, here, they're two great actors. I mean, you can't, you know, you have to give them that. They're very fine actors and have made a lot of good movies and get good performances. Not just those, but, you know, as you say, it's often for a body of work and not maybe just a single movie. So they said, well, all hats off to the two of them. Great actors. But they also said, it's in a way a tribute to all the black actors who've ever been, and then people said, you know, they said some big stuff. They said, now what this is a turning point. This means the door is now finally open in Hollywood, you know, to black creative people, and it's good for actors, it's good for directors. This is big. We're going to see a big change now. Okay, so it hasn't been all that long, but do you think that was as important an event? And even at this short amount of time, could you see, has anything changed?
I mean, it's better. I mean, it'd be cynical to say that's not better. In fact, I'm fortunate because I have access to the elders. I talk to Harry Belafonte, to Ossie Davis, to Melvin Van Peebles, and I look at the hardships they went through. And I can't, how dare I complain the things they overcame to make movies. So clearly it's much, much, much better from the time and the obstacles they had to overcome. Do we have further to go? Of course. But I think that the real progress will come from an economic rationales and imperative as opposed to people being socially responsible or socially conscious. I think that when black film in America has the same kind of potency as black music in America, I mean, you look at the box, I think recently in the last 30 days on the top 10 pop charts, 7 people were African American. So, hey. So we need to connect in that way, and then I think that's when the permanent change will be in place. But I take incremental progress. You know, it beats the opposite.
Let me introduce again our guest. We're about midway through this part of Focus. We're talking with Warrington Hudlin. He's an authority on African American cinema. He's one of the founders of the Black Filmmaker Foundation. He has curated and programmed black film festivals around the world. He's also been producer and director of popular feature films, including House Party and Boomerang. He is here visiting the campus. He's going to give a talk about some of his experiences growing up in East St. Louis and being in Hollywood and making movies all the way now that we're into the digital age, all of that. And if you're interested in hearing more from him, stop by the Levis Faculty Center on the U of I campus. It's on Illinois Street in Urbana this afternoon, 4 o'clock. He'll be giving a talk. It's sponsored by the Afro-American Studies and Research Program and a lot of other folks, too. And too many names too numerous to mention. I can't thank everybody, but I also want to mention them particularly. And questions are welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL.
You know, and I didn't answer the part of the question about the future movie making given these exploding budgets. And actually that speaks to what I'm currently involved in, which is digital filmmaking, which is this new technological shift that really changes the whole movie making paradigm, particularly the financial paradigm, in which now movies can be made for extremely low budgets. And I think a lot of filmmakers, not only African-American filmmakers, but all filmmakers who are working outside the studio system, they're taking this technology to have greater opportunity. I was talking to filmmakers in Latin America, and there's certain Latin American countries where all the movies are being done digitally because they can't afford, their economies can't support anything else. So I think digital filmmaking is certainly the future.
Let's talk with another listener in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, when you're talking about the Academy Awards and the rationales, this brought up for me something where still kind of irks me in a way. And I, you know, I have nothing against Jeff Bridges. I think he's a fine actor. But as I recall, the year he won the Academy Award for Starman, Joe Morton played a very similar part in Brother from Another Planet as an alien. And I thought his performance was far better than Jeff Bridges. And I don't know if they were rewarding Jeff Bridges for something else or if it's just because, you know, John Sayles, an independent filmmaker, is making this and you know, a black actor. But, I mean, to this day, I think that the performance Joe Morton put in as a space alien was far better than what Jeff Bridges did.
Well, I'm a big Joe Morton fan. He's a friend, and I just think that he consistently does very, very fine work. But let me bring your listeners to a performance that I'm. It's not African American, but it's a stunning performance that I'm hoping the Academy is going to recognize. That's Sean Penn in Mystic River. I went to the premiere of it at New York Film Festival, and I was just stunned. It's just a truly amazing performance. But also segues to what you said before about how there's a sensitivity about certain kinds of images on the screen. Well, the characters in Mystic River were really working-class white ethnics who, if that was cast black, there may be some concern about why you're showing that class of people. Mm-hmm. But if you're going to do drama, if you're going to explore human condition, no segment of our community should be kept off camera. We should talk about everybody and the filmmaker's obligation to go where the drama is. And Clint Eastwood in Mystic River found characters whose backgrounds had real drama. And Sean Penn is amazing.
I'm just curious if you would consider Brother from Another Planet to be one of those movies by a white director that falls into your definition of a black movie.
No, although I to give John Sayles big credit, he gave me a personal call when he's making the movie. He said, listen, I'm a white director, and it's a black movie, and I want to hire as many black people as possible, so please give me a list of names. And I gave him a list of names, and sure enough, he hired a lot of black people, and I really applaud him for having that kind of sensitivity, because movie making is a business, and a lot of money is changing, even on low budgets, it's a lot of money changing hands. But, you know, back to why Brother from Another Planet didn't get recognition. That movie was pre the ascendance of Miramax and the so-called classic divisions. I think that movie came out later. There have been companies that we had the marketing muscle to get more recognition. It's just before its time.
Well, thanks.
All right, thank you. I wanted to get your thoughts about Barbershop, a movie that, well, first of all, I thought it was a wonderful movie, a very sweet, and I think in a lot of ways a very old-fashioned kind of a movie, and a movie that was somewhat controversial because of some of the things that one of the characters, this character of this sort of cranky older barber, the senior guy, played by Cedric the Entertainer, the comic, some of the stuff that he said. He said some pretty outrageous stuff, and the kinds of things that, you know, what people might think, but saying it out loud, now that's something else. And I wonder what you thought about the film, and particularly the controversy surrounding that character.
Well, that controversy drew me in. In fact, I had the unenviable experience of going on BET News to debate Al Sharpton on that very point. That really tested my skills, because I mean, Al Sharpton is a master speaker. But I think on this issue, he was wrong. And he was really saying that the filmmakers need to apologize and be censored. And what I said to Reverend Sharpton was that one of the things that's powerful about black art is that it's the one segment of our society that can always speak out. That is unmuzzled. Whether it be going back to Dick Gregory's comedy or some of the music, we need someone, and all healthy societies need a character in our community who has no obligation, who can speak, you know, without biting their tongue. And oftentimes we will not be happy with what they're saying, but we need that kind of freedom of expression. And I think that anytime we censor that, and I think that the one moment he may begin to see my point, I said, well, if we say that Dr. King, who obviously is one of the greatest human beings of the 20th century, if he's off limits because he's a protected entity, then why not some people say George Bush? Now, I want my freedom to go after George Bush. In fact, we will. And so therefore I can't have a list of who's on, who's off. Everybody has to be on the list. In order for me to preserve my right to be critical of George Bush, I may have to let someone else be critical of Dr. King. Mm-hmm.
I also wanted to ask you or give you a chance to talk a little bit about Boomerang, the film that you produced, because I remember at the time that this film came out, people were saying that, okay, here we have it's a romantic comedy with a black cast, and people talked about that like it was some kind of revolutionary thing. And I'm interested in hearing you talk about that, and also whether, in fact, you think that film, which certainly was a successful film, whether that had some sort of did that change the atmosphere at all? Did the fact that film got made, then did that start people thinking about that there were possibilities for doing films and for doing films with black casts that before they wouldn't have thought about?
Yeah, I mean, in many ways, Boomerang is a litmus test for America as well as the Hollywood system. It had a tremendous connection with audiences. People really would see it over and over and over again, which is very gratifying for me. But Hollywood did not want to acknowledge it as a successful film, even though it made $120 million around worldwide. And in fact, that year it came out, it was the third highest grossing film for Paramount Pictures. Yet they kept spinning it that it wasn't successful. And I try to resist being a conspiracy theorist, but it was truly a black film. Eddie Murphy called me up and said, hey, I love House Party. I want you to make this movie. And I want you and your brother to direct it. And we really had control. It was amazing. And we had a lot of money. And I remember calling the studio and saying, hey, you know, we need a helicopter for this shot. Oh, no, 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 it's not in the budget. So I go, I said, Eddie, Paramount says no money. What? Da-da-da. Next day I had the money. And it's an amazing experience for me as a filmmaker, having this kind of star extend me all his clout. And we did amazing things. I mean, if you think about the cast, everybody from Eartha Kitt and Jeffrey Holder to Martin Lawrence and David Alan Greer and Robin Givens. It was just an amazing, amazing assembly of the best and brightest of the time. And many ways, some people say that's a movie that really, Halle Berry really came into a national prominence in terms of people's imaginations. So the movie had resonance because I think it says that you can tell a story about upscale, very beautiful, African Americans living very successful lives.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think that certainly some people would, you know, people would acknowledge that there are a lot of really fine African American actors working today, and among them there are people like Will Smith and Halle Berry and Denzel Washington and Lawrence Fishburne and people who are movie stars in every sense of the word. They are movie stars. One of the things I'm curious about, though, is if you look at the makeup of Actors Equity, you know, the union actors, what percentage of Actors Equity is black? No,
but you can go to the SAG website.
I'm sure you can find it.
And the thing is that it's every year, both SAG, with the Screen Actors Guild, the Directors Guild, the Writers Guild, they have these reports. And every year, I don't know if it's every year, but frequently there's reports, and they all cry and protest the fact that our participation isn't full. And it's an ongoing, chronic problem.
Mm. What kind of movies would you... are there a certain kind of movies that you think you would like to make that you haven't yet had the chance and maybe someday you would like to do?
Yes, absolutely. And I had the rights to a book called Middle Passage. It won a National Book Award. It's written by a MacArthur Fellow, the Genius Grant, Charles Johnson. And it's about the Middle Passage, the slave trade between Africa and the United States. Amazing, stunning, 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 stunning book. Mm-hmm. And the studio bought it for me, and I'm developing the script, and I bring it in, and it was a moment I never forget. And it was actually the moment that I realized that my ability to work in Hollywood would be limited. So I'm in a meeting with the studio executive, junior executive, not senior executive. He says, so you know, in meetings you have these discussions about character motivation. He says, now tell me again, why do the slaves want to be free?
You're kidding.
Nope. And I said, you know, what do I do? Do I get up and walk out? Do I smack him? What do I do? But the main thing I realized is that there's a disconnect. And it's just hard to, what can you do? And so that's why one foot stays in Hollywood, but the other foot is looking for opportunities to work outside of Hollywood, because I just know that there's stories I want to do. They will never, ever finance, sanction, promote, etc. But that's okay, because my responsibility has to be more than artistic. I have to be a businessman, too. I have to be a marketer, too. And I'm willing to do that. I mean, the people who came before me worked so hard. At least I can do my part.
Mm-hmm. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. We're talking with filmmaker Warrington Hudlin. And as I mentioned, he is very much involved in black independent film in this country. In fact, he's one of the founders of the Black Filmmaker Foundation, has had a very important role in the emergence of the contemporary black independent film movement. He's been a curator and programmer for black film festivals all over the world, has also been producer and director of some popular and successful feature films, and we mentioned a couple of them, House Party and Boomerang 2, that you might have seen. Where are the immortal kid in play these days?
Play is now a minister in Alabama.
Really?
And kid has become a stand-up comic. Who would have thought it?
How many people do you suppose went out and got fade haircuts?
Quite a few. But you know, to piggyback what I said earlier, one of the reasons why I created an online community, which is at www.dvrepublic.org, DV as in digital video, dvrepublic.org, is that there needs to be that space, that digital space in which movie making is not expensive, in which stories can be told that would not be told in those kind of more restrictive commercial contexts. And so what we do at DV Republic, it really is not simply a website. It's an online community. And we actually have discussions. Like discussions we're having right now on the air now, we have those discussions on this website. And people talk about movies and make comments, and we pose a question. And we're really trying to build a critical nexus, like a community around the notion that there's a room for another kind of cinema.
I think we get another caller lined up here, and certainly if there are folks who have questions would like to call in, talk with our guest, we have a good 7-8 minutes left. 333-9455, that's for Champaign-Urbana, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We have a Champaign caller here on line number one. Hello.
Yes, just want to know, I have already spoken to you. Where are you going to be speaking on campus so we can get a chance to see you or talk to you?
Sure. This afternoon, 4 o'clock, at the Levis Center.
Okay.
In Urbana.
And that's open to the public?
Yes, sir.
Okay, we're going to be there.
Great.
And make sure you log on to the DV Republic, because that's an ongoing year-round discussion on online.
Okay. Look forward to seeing you.
All right. Very good.
Take care.
And other people, again, if you have a question, do call in here. Don't wait till the very last minute. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I know that, Red, you directed Tim Meadows in
My brother did, yes.
I'm sorry, it was your brother. Well, see, now that's what happens when you got two guys with the same name.
So
he directed that movie. What I was just curious about was how, you know, we have movies like that are kind of affectionate send-ups of those movies that were being made, I don't know what, in the 1960s. You have a movie like that, or you have a movie like Undercover Brother. And I guess, so what are, what you think about movies like that, and whether that's, I guess it's an homage in one sense. It's affectionate. Is that purely what it is?
Yeah, I mean, it's fun. My brother's new project, interesting enough, is, I don't know if your listeners know the comic strip Boondocks.
Yeah, in fact, the guy who drew it was sat right there in that chair.
Well,
not all that long ago.
Well, yeah. Aaron Magruder has partnered with my brother Reginald Hudlin, and they're gonna make that a TV show on the Fox Channel, Fox Network, which is what a shock. But that's his new project.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure the Fox, anything they think is gonna make money, that would be okay with them. Let's talk to somebody here also on mobile phone line two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi, I've tuned in late, and so I hope you haven't already addressed the question that I have to ask. But first of all, I'm very excited to hear so many of the things that you're saying. My question is kind of a practical one for African-American actors. I'm a voice and speech teacher, and I coach African-American actors in voice and speech, and have done so especially in Shakespeare. But what advice do you have for African-American actors? I've heard folks from Chicago, casting directors and the like, say that good African-American actors are in demand, and that's a wonderful thing to hear. But what advice do you have for young actors who are just entering the field? What is it that you look for, that you find exciting, or what is it that you're seeking specifically?
Well, I think the thing we're all looking for is, of course, talent. But I think that one of the things that actors have to ask themselves is this what you really, really want to do? I know it sounds strange that I would pose this question, but I pose it because I have so many friends who are actors, and it's so difficult. And that those of my friends who really have, I could be an actor or something else, after a year or two, they end up being something else. But those who really, really are totally committed, it's like acting or die, those are people who really make it to the top, become very successful, if you really have that kind of passion and drive. And the other thing about acting, and I start off by talking about their talent, but it's also a sad fact that it's who you know is as important as what you know. And to the extent that actors can network with writers and producers and directors, that advances their career. The one bit of advice I would say to actors, and they could be at the beginning of their career or the top of their career, is that make alliance with writers, because unfortunately the roles you're being offered are not substantial. In fact, they tend to be silly. And you really can't show how good you are because the material you're given doesn't afford that opportunity. So I would collaborate with writers to create original material that really shows what they can do as actors, and that would certainly help them get new opportunities.
That's great advice. I mean, it really is. You really are a business when you become an actor. Unfortunately, we really like to focus on the artistic aspects of it and put all of our energy into that. But you really do have to be a business person and represent yourself in that way.
Yes.
Thank you very
okay,
much. That's
thank
great
you.
Advice.
Thank we'll you. Try to get one more here. Champaign County, line one. Hello.
Hi. I'm confessing here, watching maybe junk popular culture, but it was spurred by the idea of talking about roles that you'd like to see portrayed. And I've watched this program 24. I tell myself it's just sociological to see how they're portraying all of this. And they have these, well, anyway, cut to the chase because there's so little time. They have a black president, and they've just started a theme of an interracial affair with the black president, but it turns out the woman's going to be the heavy again, and I've already seen that with the African American woman. That was, I don't know if you have anything to say about that, but it just strikes me as peculiar that you know they're doing something having a black president portrayed, but then they're going to start this interracial romance by you know having her betray him like her.
The thing
are
is,
you watching it at all? I mean, is it worth any time at all? I don't know.
Oh yeah, and you know, TiVo. You know, get your TiVo. You can see everything. But if I could use a question that could segue to another remark about interracial romances. So I think the one that was really incredibly important in almost in terms of TV milestone was, if you remember, Ally McBeal. There's an interracial romance between her and Jesse Morton. Jesse Martin. And what's interesting about that relationship is that race was never mentioned. Because you're right, it's part of the formula. They have, they cross racial lines, and that becomes a plot point, and one family doesn't like them. That's kind of almost cliche now. And but when you have this interracial relationship and there's never mention of race, that is groundbreaking.
We're going to have to stop because we've just come here to the end of our time, but I do want to mention once again that if you're interested in hearing more from our guest, Warrington Hudlin, he'll be talking this afternoon. Many of these happen at night, but this is in the afternoon. It's part of the MillerCom series this afternoon at 4 o'clock at the Levis Faculty Center on West Illinois Street in Urbana, and it's open to anyone who is interested in attending. You should certainly feel welcome.